Yemeni army says it has launched an attack on Abha Airport in southern Saudi Arabia. The U.S. Democratic Senate Majority Leader slams as un-American the acquittal of former President Donald Trump in his impeachment trial. New data point to racial disparities in the coronavirus vaccine rollout in the U.S., with blacks, Hispanics, and other ethnic minorities receiving fewer doses of vaccines. Marcia Hashmi, thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Yemeni army says it has a target at Abha Airport in Saudi Arabia's southwestern province of Asr. Army spokesman Yahya Saadi says the airport was hit with two drones. He said the attack was in response to Saudi airstrikes and is all-out blockade on Yemen. The military has previously said Saudi Arabia uses Abha and other airports to launch airstrikes on Yemen. Now, the kingdom launched its ongoing war on Yemen in March of 2015. Since then, tens of thousands of Yemenis, and mostly women and children, have been killed. Millions of others have been displaced. Well, 10 years have passed since an uprising roared into life in Bahrain against an undemocratic regime. People in the Persian Gulf Kingdom still hold rallies, though sporadic, to make their voices heard and to condemn the ruling Al-Khalifa's crackdown on their popular movement. Bahrainis seem adamant in their pursuit of reform on the anniversary of the 2011 revolution. More in this report.
February 14, 2011 was the beginning of an uprising in Bahrain that brought tens of thousands of people through streets across the tiny island to call for reform. But the peaceful movement soon turned bloody when the Al-Khalifa dynasty began to quell demonstrations with an iron fist. Backed by forces deployed from Saudi Arabia in the early months of the uprising and mercenaries from other countries, the Bahraini regime launched a brutal clampdown. The heavy-handed response saw scores of people dead, thousands arrested, and many tortured in custody over years. The unprecedented suppression drew international outcries, but those outcries failed to stop a kingdom that hosts the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet.
The United States, of course, wishes to keep that Fifth Fleet over there, because as a result of the Fifth Fleet, it is able to destabilize the region and terrorize people in the region. And so it serves America's interest to keep this regime in power so that America's Fifth Fleet can continue to operate from there.
Emboldened by foreign support, the Manama regime dissolved the main opposition party, Al-Wafaq, in 2016 and put its leaders behind bars. It also revoked the citizenship of hundreds of people, including prominent cleric Sheikh Isa Qasim. From the Iranian city of Qom, the 84-year-old spiritual leader marked the uprising anniversary via televised address.
With time, we can see that people have continued their uprising, and they continue to achieve their aspirations and their demands, and they have great aspiration in order to reach their demands, no matter how long it would take.
He said the uprising seeks to rectify the wrongdoings of the Al-Khalifa regime. He noted that the Bahraini people want to take control of their own country. On the eve of the uprising anniversary, Bahrainis staged nationwide rallies, including in the capital Manama, and renewed their call for the downfall of King Hamad and his monarchy. The demonstrators also demanded that all political prisoners be freed. 10 years after the first wave of demonstrations rocked Bahrain, people are still hoping that their resistance would bring about democratic reforms, progress on human rights, as well as accountability for past and present abuses.
Well, back to our previous story in dealing with the situation in Yemen. We're going to cross over and talk to our correspondent there in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, about the situation. Abdul Latif, please fill us in. We have these reports of an attack by Ansar Allah on the Abha airport in Saudi Arabia. Please fill us in if you have more information.
Thank you, Marzia. Two drones, one of them is Qasif K2, the other one is Samad 3. They were launched to target Abha airport. Maybe this is the fourth time this month this airport is targeted. This is maybe a proof that there are military targets inside the airport, and it is being used for military purposes. The Yemeni army has warned earlier Saudi Arabia to stop using the civilians, facilities for military purposes, but they haven't. The continued targeting for this airport is a proof that it is being used for military purposes. It comes in the conjunction with the continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward the city of Marib, which is witnessing now confrontations in three fronts. The Yemeni army maybe will announce the coming few days that the city of Marib will be liberated. This is a pressure on the Saudi Arabia to stop escalating its war on Yemenis, to stop or to lift the siege on Yemenis. 12 oil vessels are still detained. Yemen is suffering a severe fuel crisis, and this is and these operations are in response to this escalation held by Saudi Arabia. Thousands of health facilities are now threatened to be closed at any moment. They have no fuel to generate power for the medical equipment. So we believe that the Yemeni army will continue its operations, will continue to target Saudi facilities, to pressure Saudi Arabia, because the United Nations and the international community did nothing until the moment to help Yemenis to end the suffering of the Yemeni people. So the Yemeni army will continue its operations until the war is stopped and the siege is lifted.
Abdul Latif, is there any optimism on the ground with the, a couple of things have taken place with the United States actually rescinding, calling Ansar Allah a terrorist group, and also it seems that some of the European entities, and also the United States was talking about not supporting Saudi Arabia in dealing with the situation in Yemen and cutting back on the weapons. Is there optimism at all, or basically is it a perspective that the pressure must continue to try to force Saudi Arabia into giving up this ruthless war?
Yemenis are optimistic, but carefully. They believe that these are still, till the moment, only media statements. There's nothing on the ground. The Saudi-led coalition is still continuing to target Yemeni facilities, to target civilians. The confrontations on the ground are still continuous. So we believe that these are only statements on the media, and the ground, the field, is the proof that there are real intentions from the United States and the European community to help the Yemenis and end the suffering of the Yemenis. But until the moment, we are optimistic. Yemenis are optimistic, but carefully, until we see something on the ground and something real, real steps.
All right, thanks so much for that update out of Sana'a. That's Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Now to the United States, where the Senate there votes to acquit former President Donald Trump, sparing him from conviction in his second impeachment trial in a year.
The Senate, having tried Donald John Trump, former President of the United States, upon one article of impeachment exhibited against him by the House of Representatives, and two-thirds of the senators present, not having found him guilty of the charge contained therein, it is therefore ordered and adjudged that the said Donald John Trump be, and he is hereby, acquitted of the charge in said article.
the upper chamber of Congress voted 57 guilty against 43 not guilty. That fell short of the two-thirds majority needed to convict Trump. He was accused of inciting an insurrection on the Capitol last month as lawmakers were certifying Joe Biden as the next president. Despite his acquittal, a bipartisan majority cast votes found Trump guilty. In a statement, Trump, however, called the trial the greatest witch hunt in U.S. history. He added that his political movement, quote, has just begun. But Biden said the substance of the charges against Trump is not in question, despite his acquittal. That was echoed by Senate Republican Mitch McConnell.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it.
Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer also slammed the vote to exonerate Trump as un-American. He said the 43 senators who voted not guilty will forever be linked to Trump's, quote, terrible legacy. Democrats had warned that acquitting the former president would open the door for future presidents to violate their office in the final weeks of their presidency without suffering any accountability. Earlier, we were joined by Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., who briefed us on the outcome of Trump's impeachment trial.
The Senate voted to acquit the president, and the former president, and I think that was to be expected. This whole week, we've been listening to testimony from both sides and the widespread criticism of the former president's defense team as they cobbled together an argument that at times seemed rambling and unfocused, but at other times just seemed somewhat sophomoric, especially in the montage of the word fight, which was part of their defense. The whole time, people knew, most everyone knew, that the president, former president, would be acquitted and that he would not be convicted. There are only 7 Republicans who joined Democrats, far short of the 17 that they needed. And I believe that many didn't even think that they would get 7 at times. There was this argument that the former president couldn't be put on trial because he was not the president anymore, and impeachment was focused on presidents or people who are still holding office. But there was precedent that had already been set that not everyone who is found guilty to be impeached needed to be in office. But the Republicans largely did not want to believe that. They did not want to accept that in part of their decision making. And one could only think that it's mostly partisan, that they still wanted to show that they were in alignment with Trump, that they supported the Republican Party, and they didn't want to face a lot of their constituents who they would have a lot of questions to answer if they had voted to convict former President Trump.
Meanwhile, new data show the U.S. is struggling with racial disparities in the COVID immunization, with blacks, Hispanics, and other ethnic minorities receiving fewer doses of vaccines in the state of Washington. While the data released by the state's health department suggests that just a quarter of Hispanics have received the vaccine, despite accounting for 13.2% of the population in Washington. Among other ethnic groups that make up 4.3% of the state's population, just 0.3% have been fully vaccinated. By contrast, nearly 66% of whites have been administered the vaccine so far. There have been similar reports from other states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Mississippi, and Florida, suggesting that blacks are receiving vaccinations at dramatically lower rates than white Americans. A CNN analysis of 5 metro areas, including Chicago, Atlanta, and Houston, showed a similar trend against blacks and Hispanics. Now, the notorious Guantanamo Bay prison has been linked to many controversies, including the use of horrendous torture methods on detainees. The U.S. established a facility in 2002 and kept the 9/11 attack suspects there without charges, despite international outcries. Now, President Joe Biden has announced that he will close the prison, but will he succeed or will he fail like his former boss, Barack Obama?
On September 11, 2001, 2 hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings in New York City, resulting in the death of nearly 3,000 people. In the wake of terrorist attacks, the U.S. administration, led by then-President George W. Bush, declared a war on terror, arguing that the need to counter terrorism and people's safety overrides the obligation to respect human rights. With that incentive, the Guantanamo Bay Prison, also known as Gitmo, was established in southern Cuba in January 2002 to hold inmates in a place neither the U.S. nor international law applied. Since then, Guantanamo has been synonymous with human rights abuses perpetrated by the U.S. government in the name of terrorism. Since its establishment, the notorious prison has been under fire for the so-called enhanced interrogation methods used on inmates to force them to confess to crimes that they might not have even committed. Interrogation methods which international human rights advocates say amounted to torture. Back in 2019, the New York Times published an article containing disturbing methods of torture on a prisoner named Abu Zubaida. It included methods like waterboarding, walling, and sleep deprivation. At its peak, over 750 inmates have been held in the facility since its establishment. However, based on an Amnesty International report, only seven have been convicted, including five as a result of pretrial agreements under which they pleaded guilty, returned for a possibility of being released from the base. Currently, 40 inmates are incarcerated in Guantanamo without any charges. They are stuck in a legal limbo, languishing there for nearly two decades. That is while the proceedings have been delayed at the pretrial stage for several years. That justifies why Guantanamo Bay Prison is a symbol of lingering U.S. injustice. Meanwhile, the conditions in the detention camp are deteriorating. According to a New York Times article following the tropical rains this summer and fall, raw sewage sloshed inside cells and toilets overflowed. Such unsanitary conditions become more alarming when we consider the potential impact on containing the spread of the coronavirus within the prison. Moreover, in late January, the Pentagon halted the plan to offer COVID-19 vaccinations to Guantanamo Bay prisoners. That has raised criticism from health experts and rights groups, as they say prisoners must be high on the priority list to get the vaccine because they are in close contact with the prison staff. With the prisoners stuck in legal limbo, deteriorating infrastructure, and international outcry against torture and injustice, why has the prison been allowed to continue to operate?
Well, it's only because of the power of the United States that it can continue to operate. It's clearly in violation of international law. And people are held without charge in many cases and held indefinitely. And we know that many, many, many hundreds and hundreds of people who were taken to Guantanamo were taken there because they had been turned in by enemies.
Moving on to other news this hour, the Ghanaian government has officially declared a new Ebola epidemic in the country.
Very early this morning, the Suffolk Conakry laboratory confirmed the presence of the Ebola virus. So this puts Guinea in a situation of an Ebola epidemic. There were a total of seven cases, including three deaths. Of the seven, four were men and three were women. Three were isolated, one in Conakry and two in Zerikore.
The Ghanaian health officials said the patients showed symptoms such as diarrhea, vomiting, and bleeding after attending a burial ceremony on February the 1st. The health agency also said it is in contact with a vaccine manufacturer to get the necessary doses as quickly as possible. The World Health Organization has said it is on full alert and would rapidly send help. The last major Ebola outbreak in West Africa started in Guinea in 2013. It continued for 3 years and killed over 11,000 people across the region. The Ebola virus is spread through contact with bodily fluids. It has a much higher death rate than COVID-19. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The limelight.
The Biden administration sparked a sense of hope around the world that the war on Yemen could finally be over. For those on the ground, though, the bombs keep falling. Food is scarce and hope is in the short supply, says Ahmad Abdul Karim, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "This is Yemen after Biden declared an end to American support for the war." Stay tuned for the details, please. Seated next to his 13-year-old daughter, Hakima's bed in Thawra Hospital, Al-Hanishi watches a breaking news report on a small TV screen announcing that the President of the United States has announced an end to U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on his country. But Al-Hanishi took the news with skepticism. The Biden said he will end support to Mohammed bin Salman, but will help Saudi Arabia to defend herself. "Come on," said Al-Hanishi, who asked that only his first initial and tribal surname be used for fear of reprisal. Al-Hanishi now lives in Dubi village in Yemen's Nim district, about 25 miles east of Sana'a, after living for years as an internally displaced person in the country's capital. He remembers the moment that the war on his country was first announced from a podium in Washington, D.C., by Adel al-Jubeir, the former Saudi ambassador to the United States, and he believes just as it began in Washington, the war can only end from there. Despite the recent talk of the U.S. ending support for the war, the Saudi-led coalition has only intensified military maneuvers in Yemen in recent weeks. Saudi regime warplanes are seen regularly above highly populated urban areas in the north of the country, dropping hundreds of tons of weapons, most supplied by the United States regime. In the oil-rich Mareb province, Saudi warplanes are trying to prevent local militant groups and militias once allied with the Saudi-led coalition. Since February 3rd, when the Biden administration announced it would end support for offensive Saudi regime action against Yemen, the Saudi-led coalition has also doubled down on its blockade of the country, preventing oil ships and even materials used to dispose of unexploded ordnance, including cluster bombs, from entering the country. in Saadé, Hajjeh, and the oil-rich Ma'reb province more than 150 airstrikes using the U.S.-made bombs, including MK 81, 82, 83, 84 cluster bombs, have been carried out according to Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center, YEMAC, an organization backed by the United Nations. These attacks could not happen without a green light from the United States regime. And all the talk about peace and an end to support for Riyadh are little more than talk for the sake of diplomatic consumption. Last week, Hakima al-Hanishi lost her left hand to an unexploded ordnance. She was playing with her younger brother when they came upon an unusual-looking object they thought looked like a toy. But it was not a toy. It was an unexploded cluster munition dropped by a Saudi jet. Ali Safra, the Director General of the Yemen Executive Mine Action Center, YEMAC, said that the civilian casualties from unexploded ordnances far exceed 1,000. Most are women and children from agricultural and grazing areas. Safra says that the Saudi-led coalition has dropped 3,179 cluster bombs on Yemen, including the BLU-616397AB, the M-71, the BLO-108, and BLO-77, all U.S.-made cluster bombs. Safra says that European and Latin American cluster bombs, such as the British BMLT-12, the French ZP-39, and Brazilian SA-2, have also been used. Altogether, YEMAC has identified at least 13 different types of cluster bombs, all dropped by warplanes, most often supplied by the United States regime, and often on hospitals, schools, markets, mosques, farms, factories, bridges, and power and water treatment plants. Over there, they're talking about peace. But here, we hear nothing but the roar of American-made warplanes over our heads and the sounds of explosions from their bombs, one father told Mint Press News. His 13-year-old son, Rad, and two children, 13-year-old Ragat Saleh Al-Shaul and 10-year-old Najwa Ali Matari, are being treated for serious injuries at Al-Thawra Hospital after they were struck by cluster bomb as they were grazing their sheep in Al-Ghafra in nearby Sana'a province. We need an end to the airstrikes and a lifting of the blockade, not deceptive statements by the United States regime, Rad's father added angrily. Biden's announcement to end support to Saudi Arabia did little to alleviate Yemeni's concerns. It lacked clarity or specificity as to what policies would be introduced to effect that change. It did not mention the blockade on Yemen, and it reiterated Washington's support for Saudi Arabia's right to defend itself. That statement left many Yemenis feeling that Biden was expressing sympathy towards Saudi Arabia regime and ignoring the plight of Yemenis who have been much harder hit by the war. Doctors struggling to keep 13-year-old Hakima alive say she must travel abroad for treatment as Al-Thawra Hospital, like most in Yemen, is suffering from a shortage of medical equipment, medicine, and lack of fuel to run generators. I cannot evacuate her. The airport is closed. What am I supposed to do? Hakima's father asked Main Press. The ongoing blockade on Sana'a's international airport, imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and supported by the United States regime, has caused the deaths of more than 80,000 medical patients. More than 450,000 patients still need to travel abroad to receive treatment, according to the Director General of the Sana'a International Airport, Khaled Al-Shaif, as well as a number of civil society organizations that participated in a joint press conference recently. According to the Yemeni Ministry of Health, over 3,000 patients registered with the ministry suffer from cardiac abnormalities and urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. Over 12,000 patients with kidney failure need urgent transplants, and more than 65 cases of cancer risk death if they are unable to get treatment outside of Yemen. He confirmed that the airport is completely safe and in complete technical readiness to receive flights, indicating that the only obstacle to reopening the airport and lifting the ban is the intransigence of the coalition countries and the complicity of the United Nations. The United States regime has not only been complicit in supporting Saudi attacks, which have killed more than a quarter of a million people, destroyed infrastructure, and left Yemen one of the most heavily contaminated countries in the world. It has directly assisted in the enforcement of a blockade that has caused Yemen's complete economic collapse. Yemenis are now left with the stark reality that Biden's statements have changed little on the ground. People are still suffering from cholera, malnutrition, and starvation, from horrific atrocities and indiscriminate bombing and shelling, from the destruction of infrastructure and the economy. Hundreds of thousands have perished, millions are displaced, and tens of millions have been left impoverished. The long-term effects of malnutrition and trauma on an entire generation of young Yemenis ensure the cost of this war will continue for decades to come. Just as the war was announced from Washington, the only likely end to the war will be announced from Washington.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we looked at how the ongoing epidemic of men's violence in America is rooted in this inability as a society to move beyond outmoded ideals of manhood. In a sweeping analysis that cut across racial, ethnic, and class lines, we examined mass shootings, day-to-day gun violence, violence against women, bullying, and American militarism against the backdrop of a culture that has normalized violent and regressive forms of masculinity in the face of challenges to traditional male power and authority. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
It turns out that Lord Baden-Powell bonded the Boy Scout for a very explicit reason, to counteract what he perceived as a decline in the manly virtues. In his influential book, Rovering to Success, A Guide to Young Manhood, Powell was quite explicit about this. God made men to be men, he wrote. Civilization, with its town life, buses, hot and cold water laid on, everything done for you, tends to make men soft and feckless beings. We badly need training for our lads if we are to keep up manliness in our race instead of lapsing into a nation of soft, sloppy cigarette suckers.
The Scout program is designed to help our sons, cousins, and younger brothers develop the initiative, the resourcefulness, the character, the quick thinking, and the leadership they really need in the somewhat jittery, insecure world in which we live.
Again and again at key moments in American history, You see men reacting to change in just this way by retreating into a hyper-masculine fantasy world. You see it in the rise of popular men's magazines in the 1940s, filled with stories about breathtaking manly adventures in sports. These magazines may look retro to us today, but what's important to remember is that they were just as retro in their own time. As the lives of men grew more sedentary during the consumer boom of the post-war years, as women moved into the workplace in unprecedented numbers and the women's movement gained traction, these magazines offered men a way to hit back at what Ralph Day, the editorial director of True Magazine, describes as the perils of creeping equality. Men were turning to his magazine in unprecedented numbers, Day explained to a group of men in a speech, because it stimulates his masculine ego at a time when man wants to fight back against women's efforts to usurp his traditional role as head of the family. And this backlash has only accelerated exponentially since the 1960s, when the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the anti-war movement rose up to challenge traditional masculine authority like never before, especially the authority of straight white men.
Plain truth of the matter is, this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
Feminism was established so that unattractive, ugly broads could have easy access to the mainstream, right? Did you see it? Yes!
Look at our political culture, where the game is all about establishing your manly credentials by butching yourself up and methodically feminizing and taking apart the manhood of your opponents.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
There was no clearer depiction of this backlash phenomenon than the film Fight Club. The movie portrayed the emasculation of young men by the consumer culture.
We're still men.
Yes, we're men. Men is what we are.
And offered up bare-knuckled violence as a way for men to reclaim their manhood. Regardless of whether we see film as a glamorization or a satire of backlash masculinity, backyard fight clubs have proliferated in the years since the film's release. And at the base of all of this is the belief that the best way for men to restore their dwindling manhood and restore order is through what the cultural historian Richard Slotkin has called the frontier myth of regenerative violence.
Most people understand that guns make you safer, especially because society is degenerating. There's going to be a lot of craziness going on. And so we need guns to protect ourselves.
To older working and middle-class white men, the message is clear.
That's the thing that gets me. If I lived on the border and some brown man came running through my backyard that looks like he didn't belong there, then why aren't people doing that?
The basic idea is that the best way to regain power and control is through a barrel of a gun, or as many guns as possible.
They're accurate. Mm-hmm. They are dependable.
Yes, they are. Super dependable.
They are extremely well made. You can carry plenty of them
right.
on your person
right.
at all times.
This white male paranoia and siege mentality have fueled the increasingly aggressive effort to block even the most sensible gun policies.
When the system is overwhelmed, and I mean the system on the entire planet, somebody had better be prepared to protect themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the freedom of all mankind. Never let them take your Second Amendment right, ever.
This siege mentality has also fueled the rise of hate groups and militias over the past quarter century.
They're not branches of Al-Qaeda. They're right-wing extremists with lots of guns and an axe to grind against the U.S. government.
Listen, people. Things are bad. Things are real bad. And it's going to get a lot worse. So basically, if people need to wake up, start buying some of these, see?
Groups like these are often described as white supremacist hate groups, which they usually are. But they can also be seen as a kind of reactionary men's movement, an organized expression of white male anxiety and aggrieved entitlement that relies on violence as the preferred means of attaining its goals.
Recovery crews are still searching the waters around an island where a gunman opened fire on young people attending a summer camp.
In recent years, perhaps the most disgusting and morally bankrupt expression of this kind of threatened entitlement was the massacre of 77 people, including 69 teenagers, perpetrated by the Norwegian right-wing fanatic Anders Breivik, a former customer service representative who had been declared unfit for service in the Norwegian army. In his 1,500-page manifesto explaining his reasons for the attack, Breivik ranted against culturalism, but he reserved special venom for feminism's role in emasculating Western men. According to Breivik, feminist ideology and political correctness have been responsible for transforming a patriarchy into a matriarchy and intend to deny the intrinsic worth of males. And by now, men have been reduced to an emasculated, touchy-feely subspecies. What this shows is that a whole lot of men out there fear they're losing control and are turning to violence to reclaim their manhood. In his fascinating study of violence, the psychiatrist James Gilligan interviewed hundreds of violent criminals in American prisons and found that the single most powerful reason they turned to violence was because they felt shamed, humiliated, or disrespected as men. The more time I spent with him, Gilligan writes about one of the hundreds of violent criminals he has interviewed over the course of his research, the clearer it became that his character served as a defense against the threat of being treated with scorn and disrespect, of being perceived as a weakling, not a real man, someone who could be laughed at. We may not hear about it much in mainstream coverage of violence, but again and again we've seen exactly this dynamic. Young men using violence to overcome the shame of not being seen and respected as real men.
16-year-old Luke Woodham entered the commons area of Pearl High and fired off several shots.
Woodham opened fire at Pearl High School, killing two students.
Consider Luke Woodham, who carried out a school shooting in Pearl, Mississippi in the late 1990s. Woodham wrote a letter before he went on his rampage explaining himself this way. I am not insane, I am angry. I killed because people like me are mistreated every day. All throughout my life, I was ridiculed, always beaten, always hated. If I can't do it through pacifism, if I can't show you through the displaying of intelligence, then I will do it with a bullet. Murder is not weak and slow-witted. Murder is gutsy and daring.
Just minutes after firing two fatal shots at the Virginia Tech dormitory on Monday, Cho Sung-hui returned to his own dorm room and made the final preparations to mail what appears to be a video confession.
Or consider Sung-hee Cho, who committed one of the worst mass shootings in American history when he went on a shooting spree at Virginia Tech University in 2007, killing 32 people. Cho was a socially isolated, troubled young man with a history of mental health problems who had clearly bought into a cultural narrative that says the way to reclaim manhood is through projecting an image of menace and toughness, instilling fear in others, and using violence. Before he committed the Virginia Tech massacre, he wrote, produced, and starred in his own video, demonstrating how thoroughly he bought into this Hollywood script. Cho isn't the only mass murderer whose violent actions enabled him to rewrite the script of his life in order to place himself back in the manly starring role.
All you hear is like firecrackers, and then I looked out the window, and there's a kid with a trench coat and a shotgun throwing pipe bombs in the parking lot.
The Columbine killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, left behind written diaries that provide insight into how their murder of 12 classmates and a teacher was part of a conscious strategy to settle scores. In his journal, Klebold writes that he and Harris will take revenge on society.
The shooter was 36-year-old Andrew Engeldinger, an employee of the small company who had recently lost his job.
And this isn't just about young men. Again and again, we've seen the same thing with older men who commit mass shootings.
A troubled ex-husband is under arrest in a Southern California hair salon shooting that left 8 people dead.
In case after case, these men have faced grief, bitter disappointment, and feelings of failure.
The shooter, Richard Farley, was obsessed with a female colleague. He had also been laid off.
They are either chronically unemployed, have been left by their wives or girlfriends, been fired from their jobs, or have suffered some other kind of serious blow to their self-worth as men. Nothing can excuse the pathetic and cowardly way men like these use violence and destroy the lives of innocent people to make some kind of a statement. But we're kidding ourselves if we think these killings will stop unless and until we can identify and transform the larger cultural belief systems that underlie them.
From the mass shooting in Tucson aimed at former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords to the Colorado movie theater massacre, killers in many recent mass killings suffered mental illness.
Of course, there's no question that mental illness has played a role in a lot of rampage killings and mass shootings. But what never seems to get discussed is why it is that somewhere around 98% of school shootings and rampage killings have been committed by men, even though there are plenty of young women who suffer from mental illness as well. What this tells us is that violence can't be reduced to mental illness on its own, especially since the vast majority of mentally ill people are not violent at all. The bottom line is that even men who are mentally ill live and operate within a culture that has normalized violent masculinity and defined manhood in exceedingly narrow ways.
It's been widely reported school shooter Adam Lanza suffered some kind of personality disorder.
The Sandy Hook Elementary school shooter Adam Lanza may have been mentally ill, but he played out a familiar script.
He was bullied severely, brutally bullied, when he was in elementary school at Sandy Hook.
By all accounts, he was a socially awkward boy who didn't fit in and appears to have been mercilessly bullied.
That's a clip of the video game Call of Duty. It's also the game that Adam Lanza used to play.
He developed a revenge fantasy, secured firearms, and then killed his own mother before carrying out one of the most brutal and ruthless mass killings in American history. And in his own delusional and twisted way, he would recapture the sense of respect that seemed to have eluded him his whole life. The children of Newtown, like so many other innocent victims of men's violence, became theatrical props in the performance of an aggrieved, angry, and likely self-hating young man who absorbed all the wrong lessons about what it means to be a tough, strong man from the world around him. Just take a look at the ad campaign the Bushmaster Firearms Company ran prior to the Newtown massacre for the very AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle Lanza used during his killing spree. What all of this amounts to is that our violence problem seems to be a lot less about lone wolves and monsters who fail to conform to society's norms than it is about too many men, in a sense, over-conforming to our norms and ideals of manhood out of fear of not being seen as men. When we talk about men's violence and dominant ideals of violent masculinity, there's a temptation to frame things in terms of the damage men do to others. But we need to look also at the devastating harm these norms do to men themselves. This is certainly true of gun violence. Every year in this country, over 30,000 people are killed by guns, something like 85 per day. The vast majority of these victims are men, approximately 86%. But while we're used to thinking about gun violence in terms of mass shootings and urban crime, we really don't talk a lot about how most gun deaths are the result of men and boys shooting themselves. Suicide, which is really violence turned inward, accounts for close to two-thirds of all gun deaths. The vast majority of people who kill themselves with a gun are men, and white men comprise over 80% of these firearm suicides. Violence doesn't just leave physical scars. It also leaves emotional scars. Look at the cost to African-American boys and young men of living in and around violence. Violence is the leading cause of death of African-American men between the ages of 15 and 30. But they also have much higher than average rates of depression, school dropout, mental health problems linked to perpetual stress, substance abuse. And just look at the terrible toll violence has taken on the psyches of men who serve in combat zones.
In the 5 years between 2006 and 2009, more than 1,100 members of the armed services took their own lives.
Something like half of U.S. service members who have done tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have signs of trauma, depression, flashbacks, alcohol and drug problems. In her landmark study, Trauma and Recovery, Judith Herman draws a powerful connection between the experience of male combat veterans and women who are the victims of domestic and sexual violence. The sources of the violence and their context might vary, but the unifying theme is that human beings, young and old, women and men, suffer when their physical and sexual boundaries are violated. But in the case of men, this pain gets compounded by a cultural belief system that equates manhood with invulnerability and ridicules and shames men who admit to being in emotional pain. In his classic work, I Don't Want to Talk About It, the therapist Terry Real identifies the widespread phenomenon of what he calls covert depression, a condition that roughly three-quarters of American men suffer in silence out of fear of seeming like less than a real man. For many of these men, childhood trauma and other experiences of violence play a role in this depression, which then can affect not only their ability to take care of themselves physically and emotionally, but also hinder their ability to sustain healthy relationships in adult life. Despite predictable arguments that equate trying to understand or prevent violence with weakness, the bottom line is that we have to have the strength to ask these kind of questions if we want to move beyond the never-ending cycle of violence. And that starts with examining the dominant stories we tell ourselves as a culture about manhood and violence and demanding more honest and accurate representations of the personal and societal consequences of violent masculinity. War movies like Saving Private Ryan showed not only the awe-inspiring courage of the men who stormed the beaches in Normandy and fought totalitarianism during World War II, the film also captured the panic, anxiety, and sheer terror of the young men who experienced that war.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it.
I do.
I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
More recently, The Hurt Locker explored another devastating effect of battlefield trauma. Showing how the intensity and violence of war make it difficult for many veterans to adjust back to civilian life. And we saw the same kind of honest and tragic portrayal of dominant masculinity in the film The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as an over-the-hill professional wrestler whose body was ravaged by physical injury and who was so emotionally damaged by violence that he couldn't imagine life outside the glamour of the arena. Intensely realistic shows like HBO's The Wire have refused to glamorize urban street life and violent crime, directly confronting the costs young men of color too often pay for their investment in the idea that respect comes only at the business end of a Glock. And we've seen emotionally complex shows like The Sopranos, which centered on brutal mob boss Tony Soprano, a ruthless killer who intimidated everyone around him, but also portrayed him as a deeply troubled man who had recurring panic attacks and who had to battle his own anxiety and self-doubt when he turned to a woman therapist for help.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction...
And then there's Good Will Hunting, which catapulted Matt Damon to fame, with Damon playing the role of an intellectually gifted working-class tough guy who relieves the trauma of his abusive childhood by hardening himself to the world and fighting anyone who challenges him. With the support of a woman who loves him and a therapist he comes to trust, finds the courage to battle through his defenses, look inside himself, and let go of his bottled-up rage. After the Newtown Massacre, there was a lot of tough guy talk about how the cure for our violence problem is yet more violence.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
But there were other men who spoke in the wake of Newtown as well. Men like Neil Heslin, whose six-year-old son Jesse was among the 20 children gunned down that tragic day.
He was my son, he was my buddy, he was my best friend.
What was so important about his testimony was that he went beyond expressing grief for his son and directly challenged the culture of violence. Too often we define masculine strength by who can blow away the most people, who can flex the most muscle, who can impose their will and inflict the most damage. But this cheapens the real definition of strength and toughness. We respect the toughness of firefighters who rush into burning buildings when others are rushing out, police officers and other first responders who put their lives on the line, not because they're out to prove something, but because they steel themselves in the face of danger and face down their fears in service to others. For the same reason, we should respect the toughness and strength of men who challenge the myth that being a real man requires putting up a false front, disrespecting others, and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Strength is about adapting to change, not about retreating from it and lashing back with violence out of fear. And it's high time we had a definition of manhood capable of meeting that challenge.
While the program helped to diagnose the root causes of America's increasing levels of hypermasculinity, bullying, and gun violence, as well as the correlation between violence and manhood. But it seems that changing this culture, which is rooted so deeply in grotesque models of violence, is easier said than done. That's it for this week. Do join us next week here on Aperture. Until another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.